Bangly bang, bangly bang. On the Empire Podcast this week, Brian Helgeland, director of the Craze biopic Legend, drops in and brings his stars, Tom Hardy, and a newcomer called Tom Hardy. Plus, another frickin' legend, Ron Perlman, shows up and is simply awesome. All that and usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast that very nearly became the Practical Birdkeeping Podcast this week, but the paperwork didn't come through in time.
Oh, what a shame.
Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Empire Podcast. As ever, I'm joined by two colleagues of such lethal cunning. First up is our resident Jurassic Park expert, a man who knows just how long it would actually take to run from the T-Rex paddock to the main street in heels. It's Nick Desemlian.
17 seconds.
17
wow.
seconds.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
That seems dangerously close.
I tried it with and without heels. The T-Rex can almost outrun a Jeep, but not a lady in heels.
Well, we clocked the T-Rex at 32 miles per hour, right? Mm. Top speed.
We clocked Bryce Dallas Howard in heels at 34 miles an hour.
But it probably takes him a little bit of time to accelerate.
Yeah.
It's like a horse over a short distance.
Also, he's a lot older.
He is older, isn't he? He's an older T-Rex.
Paunchy.
Yeah. Has been working out a lot, eating too many lambs and lawyers. So, yeah.
They missed a gag in Jurassic World. She should have got out her compact mirror as she was running and looked in it to do her hair. And then gone, oh, the T-Rex is closer than it appears.
Can you imagine if she'd done that? The people who were already tearing this film apart. Yeah, the female lead stopped to do her hair halfway through. That'd be amazing.
Would have been a great callback.
Objects in your makeup mirror are closer than they appear. Yeah, she should get Heelys for the sequel.
Okay, then.
You know what Heelys are?
With the little wheels in the heel.
Yeah. That'd be, you know, she could sip around.
It would actually make sense for the little kid actors to have that, wouldn't it?
Yeah, although I don't know if Heelys are a thing anymore.
No, it's probably 5 years ago. Granddad.
I did see someone in Heelys the other day, like a young person,
a youth.
On Heelys at Holborn Tube Station.
I've never heard
of
this.
Get off my lawn! I said.
It sounds like something from the Jetsons.
Heelys are basically trainers, but with wheels in the heel.
Have you not seen them? They certainly wear everywhere.
Yeah.
Maybe not now.
Yeah.
I think we're off topic. Anywho.
We're off topic, and I haven't even introduced you. This is second, but decidedly not least. It's our geek queen, a lady who knows how long it takes to watch all 222 episodes of Supernatural in heels. It's Helen O'Hara.
Funny enough, it's the same amount of time it would take you in flats. It's
really?
Not one of those things where flats help.
Ah.
It's weird, isn't it?
Do you watch it in your flat?
I do.
Okay. That's wordplay. Here's an email question from Jono Forwood, who asks, who would you want to direct/star in a film about good and evil news agents? Now, if you're a first-time listener to the podcast, every month when the new issue of Empire comes out, I always say it's available from all good and evil news agents, just to be fair.
Sure.
If you're an evil news agent, you can stalk Empire just as well as a good agent news agent. So I just, you know, in the interest of fairness. So, John O'Forward goes on to say, the obvious directors would be Lord and Miller, and I would like to see Channing Tatum going up against Tilda Swinton.
I mean, that is genius. First of all, full marks.
I'm in.
For that suggestion. I would watch that.
I don't understand why it's those people, but I'm curiously excited about it.
So, I'm intrigued by this. See, I can see Channing Tatum as the small local news agent, the guy who runs a convenience store in the corner, who gets his papers in during the day, sells Mars bars at ridiculously overinflated prices, and Tilda Swinton could perhaps be the cold, callous conglomerate type.
So you're seeing this as basically Snowpiercer with a little bit less cannibalism?
I haven't said anything about cannibalism.
It's Snowpiercer.
There would still be cannibalism.
There would still be cannibalism.
The pitch,
okay.
The pitch is Snowpiercer with Haribo. And who doesn't want to watch that?
Haribo Piercer. Oh my God.
I've got a pitch for this. I had a little think last night. Here's my pitch.
You realize none of us in this room can actually green light this.
Really? Someone listening will.
Trust me. Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Ben Mendelsohn is an Empire subscriber. He gets his issue late.
No way.
After it's already out in the shops. So he goes on a crusade against news agents in general.
Oh, this is good.
So he's terrorizing news agents.
Okay.
Michael Fassbender
is
news agent.
Oh.
He's a spy who is running a news agent for some reason. He has to take down Ben Mendelsohn.
I'm going to take you down, he'll say.
Using items from his store.
Using items from my store, he'll say.
Well, I mean,
that's all I've got.
It's a really strong start.
It's like Fassbender's in the room.
It's a lot
and then
like
Ben
that.
Mendelsohn would turn around and go, no, you're bloody not, mate. Because he's Australian.
Wow, thanks for clarifying.
Yeah. Give me my Empire on time, he'd say.
Where was that from?
He was born in Australia,
mm-hmm.
but he moved when he was four to Krypton.
That's actually correct, yeah.
Right, so, that explains a lot.
Apologies to any Empire subscribers who I've offended or who have received their issues late, because we do get the odd tweet from people and they do get lost in the post sometimes and turn up late and stuff. So sorry about that.
Yeah. I thought you meant Ben Mendelsohn was actually an Empire subscriber. I was like, wow, that's blown my mind.
He might be.
You never know. Yeah. You never know.
I was thinking, I don't know why this is the thought that came to mind, but I was trying to think who sort of has a newsagent air about them but could do something different with it, you know, could do something completely different. And for some reason, the person who came to mind was Julie Walters.
Mm. Okay.
And then what I decided is that I want a rematch of the great scene that was a little bit ruined, let's be honest, in the final Harry Potter film. And that is the confrontation between Mrs. Weasley and Bellatrix Lestrange in defense of Ginny, where she says, "Not my daughter, you bitch." Now, that is my favorite moment in the novels, and it is a little bit ruined on screen. It's just not well done. I love David Yates. He did brilliant, brilliant work on those films, but he messed that one moment up for me. So I would like essentially a remake of that fight, with magic or without, I don't really care, but in through the medium of competing newsagents.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah, I'm in.
So it's Julie Walters
versus Helena Bonham Carter. As newsagents.
That's amazing. I'm all over it. I want to see a biopic of W.H. Smith.
Is it like There Will Be Blood?
Yes.
There Will Be Mars Guard.
I'm Henry Walton Smith. I haven't just Wikipedia'd that. And this is my
son, W.H. Jr. I'm a Skittles man.
Because there's so much drama in his life. Did you know, for example, in 1850, the firm opened a depot in Birmingham?
Wow.
That's a scene.
That's
a scene right there.
Gosh, imagine just seeing that on the big screen. That's just crazy.
His son is also William Henry.
Amazing.
This
is There Will Be Blood.
Yeah, it is. This is massive.
He's going to murder someone at the end using like a large piece of confectionery.
This is phenomenal. The younger W.H. Smith used the success of the firm as a springboard into politics, becoming an MP in 1868 and serving as a minister in several Conservative governments. I'll drink your milkshake that you got for free with the newspaper, collecting several coupons over a period of weeks. I drink it up! You could say. Would be a line.
That would be a line.
Says Ben Middleton. Okay. What's his name? Henry Walton Smith.
Wouldn't that be H.W. Smith?
I know. And what is the name of Daniel Day-Lewis's son?
H.W.
This is mind-blowing. By the way, when I was little, I used to call W.H. Smith Whiff Smith. I don't know why. I thought that was the name of it. So For years, I called it Whiff Smith.
Yeah. Apologies to all our non-British listeners for so many things. But mainly, W.H. Smith is the biggest chain of news agents in this country.
News agents are places that sell newspapers, yes, magazines, and sweets.
Newspapers and magazines were something that you could get in the early 21st century and late 20th century, if you're listening to this in 2020, probably. They were things printed on paper, and they had information in them about things. Although, in certain newspapers' cases, that was not the case. Not to name any names.
Mail.
Son! Right, now we've got our first soapbox. If you want to have a question read out on the Empire Podcast, you can email us podcast@empireonline.com. You can tweet us where we're at Empire Magazine. Use the hashtag Empire Podcast, and you can Facebook us as well. Okay, and a brief return to the old format of the podcast. We've got two guests this week, two belting guests this week. Very excited. Well, technically, we've got three. Technically, we've got four. But first up is one of our favourite actors. He's a man mountain hewn out of living rock, just like Nick. He's one of the best character actors around, just like Nick, with unforgettable turns in the likes of Sons of Anarchy, City of Lost Children, and most of Guillermo del Toro's glorious back catalogue, unlike Nick. Yeah. He is, of course, Hellboy himself, Ron Perlman. He's now starring in the Amazon TV show Hand of God, which is streaming now, as a judge-turned-vigilante. He came into the booth this week to talk to Nick and myself about that show, about playing the Jack Nicholson role in A Few Good Men on stage, Hellboy 3, and much, much more. And there's some salty language from the off here, so please, if you're of a sensitive disposition, don your fucking earmuffs now. We're delighted to be joined on the Empire Podcast by the star of the new Amazon TV show, Hand of God, and of course, Hellboy himself, the great Ron Perlman. How are you, sir?
It's none of your fucking business. Okay?
I'm sorry to start with such an intrusive personal question.
Very personal. let's keep it business-like,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, well, but I take it you're doing okay? You're in London for
By
a long
way,
time?
Do you mind if I take off my pants?
Absolutely. I've got mine off. Why
Good.
Not?
There
let's
you
go,
go
for it. Let's all feel very
That's
comfortable.
That's what inspired me.
You in London for a long time? Is this a little
very brief. Got in late last night and leave early tomorrow morning.
So do you get a time to do any of the tourist stuff? Do you get time to walk around and...
Not this trip.
Take snaps.
But I've been really fortunate. The business has taken me to many places for long, extensive periods of time where I get a chance to kind of rub elbows, not as a tourist, but as kind of almost like a local, hanging with the locals, working with the locals. So I spent a lot of time in London over the course of years, and I have my own sick, twisted relationship with it, like all of you blokes, as it were.
You haven't been naked in a fountain on this trip, though. We should explain Hand of God starts with you naked in a fountain, which is an interesting image.
And then where do you go from there?
Was that the moment where you read you got the script and read
I said, scene? I'm in. I'm in. Anybody would have the balls to put a 65-year-old Jew naked in a fountain. You know, who am I to argue? That's a gig worth aspiring to right there.
Was that a fun day to shoot or uncomfortable?
It was a piece of shit day.
A bad day.
But, you know, when you're a working actor, you know, you keep saying to yourself, I guess there's tougher ways to get through the day. You know, but the show is filled with challenges for whoever it was going to play the judge. And luckily that was me, because it turns out I like being in unfamiliar terrain, engagement level, ups the adrenaline level and all that. This was a role, starting with me being naked in a fountain, which was actually not the hardest scene to shoot in the pilot. And this was a role that I could tell from the get-go was going to keep me really, really in a space of kind of wonder, like unfamiliar. And I thought I would have thought that I was a pussy had I tried to dodge it, so I went with it.
Can you tell us more about the role himself? Who is the judge in Hand of God?
The judge is a man of privilege and a man of generations worth of privilege and wealth. Probably most of the streets in town are either named for his grandfather or his great-grandfather. He's that guy. Mm-hmm. And he's actually systematically put himself in a position, being a magistrate, where he really sits on the throne in the town. And he's really good at it. He can figure out a way to win in any situation, except in this situation, because he's got a son who's just shot himself and he's lying on life support and doctors are saying he's already gone. And therein begins this dialectic of, holy shit, I'm finally in a situation where not only am I losing, but I'm powerless. And not only that, but I'm losing this thing that I didn't even realize how precious it was to me. And God, would I have given a little bit more time to tell him how much I loved him, to maybe try to be a better dad and all this stuff. So this is a world of pain that this character is kind of swept into. He's flailing. He's grasping. And therein, in the grasping, he finds God, or he thinks he does anyway, and begins this very strange, twisted relationship, which leads him into hearing voices and instruction from God, which kind of puts him on this vigilante path that makes him even more questionable than you could imagine.
Do you think of roles like this as a role of a lifetime in a way? When you get a role like this, do you think in those terms?
I think that this is the role of my lifetime, yeah. I really do. There are no roles like this. The reason why I was so drawn to the series was just the writing, you know, the world that Ben Watkins created, I had never quite seen before.
The pilot's very intense. You said that the fountain scene wasn't the toughest to shoot. Can you say what was the toughest?
I mean, getting naked in a fountain is tricky, but it's not as scary to me as having to mirror a man who's on the verge of this type of loss. It tested me in ways that I've either avoided or never had the good fortune of confronting before.
On days like that, when you're shooting scenes that are emotionally tough, what's your process? Do you, in a way, lock yourself away? Do you spend a lot of time in your trailer preparing?
You know, my process as an actor is something that evolved over decades and decades of working. And I the ultimate conclusion I came to is the only time spontaneity is possible is when it comes through a completely relaxed muscle. And if you tense up or you try to anticipate or you try to pre-plan, you've removed spontaneity from the equation. So that makes it even scarier. Like, I don't know what the fuck's going to happen when he says action. I don't know whether the tears are going to flow. I don't know whether I'm going to shit my pants. I don't, you know,
That's not happened though, right? Just to...
the second one.
Who said it didn't? It didn't happen in the pilot, but you have so much to look forward to.
Do you have kind of relaxation techniques then? Do you meditate?
I try to have somebody stick a finger up my ass. No.
Every 10 minutes.
I'm sorry, darling. I didn't mean to say that. Sending a special message to my wife right now. It's my own finger, darling.
So the show is on Amazon. You can binge watch it.
Starting Friday.
From your perspective, how much has the industry changed since you came into it?
Well, it's just expanded. And in its expansion and the expansion of what's allowable on some of these broadcast networks that didn't have to comply to the rules of old traditional networks, which were family oriented and advertiser friendly. Now you have these streaming sources where you want to show a nude scene, you got it. You want to curse, you got it. You want to do a show about God, you got it. You can go as far as your imagination will take you. And this is why, you know, everyone, including myself, is actually identifying this as a new golden age in television. It springs from the fact that there are so many new players. And that means that in order to attract that limited audience, the only thing that's going to distinguish you from the last guy is originality. And when you have that as the tail that's wagging the dog, that's when you attract the greatest writers, the greatest filmmakers, the greatest actors, because this is what we all look for, is like, how do I do something that is fresh and smart and daring and bold and has never been done before?
I found Sons of Anarchy through Netflix, and I ended up binging like four seasons of that in a couple of weeks.
I mean, that's what addicted me to wanting to stay in television, was I realized I was on a show that was a real juggernaut, you know, not just for the audience, but also for the storytelling. And it's like anything else. You find a drug that you like, you just don't want to stop taking it.
Do you binge watch yourself?
I don't. I'm leaving all these phenomenal things that I want to watch off to the side for when I'm in the rocking chair and I have nothing to do but pull wax out of my ear.
So what are you working on right now?
I'm working on this fucking podcast right now. I'm just really trying to get through it.
It's a slog, isn't it?
It's a slog. Well, you know, I don't have to tell you.
Am I right in thinking you were in an episode of Miami Vice?
You are right.
Back in the day. What was that experience like?
Yeah, it was cool. I mean, you know, if you like Paisley, it was interesting.
What was your outfit? I had some good...
I was playing a kind of a boring autocrat, and I had to say lines that were really, really lame. And I remember I said, how could I say these lines that would elevate them? And I said, well, maybe if I say them like I'm some other actor, because if I say them like Ron Perlman, it's just going to lie there like warmed over shit. So I played the entire character like Burt Lancaster, who's one of my heroes. And when you go back and watch it, if you ever do, you'll see I'm not lying. Like, everything was, hello, how are you?
I'm heading to YouTube.
I was heading to YouTube, man. Get this fucking thing. You'll see an homage to Bert unlike you've ever seen before.
Have you done that since?
No, because people caught me doing it. Like, they said, hey, I think he's doing Bert Lancaster. And I went, oh, shit. I can't get away with anything.
And you did the Jack Nicholson role in A Few Good Men on stage.
No, he did the Ron Perlman role.
You got in there before him.
Yeah, I did the stage play. And he came to the Broadway play. Looking for work, obviously, because, you know, he needed the job way more than I did. But yeah, that was his introduction to the material, as did Tom Cruise. And suddenly movie stars are playing these roles that, you know, nothing but obscure motherfuckers who are just trying to pay their rent would kill for.
I mean, that must have been an interesting experience watching that happen.
It was interesting. It was kind of cool to know that Nicholson ramped up a certain degree of excitement about playing the role based on watching my performance. I mean, that's the story I'm telling me and you right now. There's no intersection between that and the truth, but we'll leave it at that.
That interchange, though, that famous scene, you know, you can't handle the truth.
You can't handle the truth.
So you were the first actor to...
No, I wasn't, actually, because I replaced Stephen Lang, who did the world premiere of, and then I was replaced by an actor named J.K. Simmons, who just won the Academy Award for Whiplash. So the more obscure the casting got, the more bizarre the takeaway is.
That's an amazing through line.
Yeah,
I'd love to see a movie with you guys. You know, Stephen like Slang as he asked us to call him yourself and J.K.
So
Simmons. That'd be amazing.
So you know Stephen if you know that he's Slang.
Yeah, he came at the not in the podcast, but he came at the office a few years ago when Avatar was out.
And yeah, he's an old friend of mine.
Great guy. Yeah. So I want to see a movie with the three of you in it right away. That's trying to send some good stuff.
We'll try to put that on the books for you.
You're also on Twitter. I follow you. You're very funny on Twitter.
Thank you.
At Permutations.
Unlike today, where I'm just bombing. I'm bombing.
No, I'm loving it. I'm loving it.
I'm laying eggs.
I get the feeling from your Twitter account that a lot of stars maybe will get their assistants to do it for them, but I get the sense it's you. You're actually typing your own tweets and
I do my own tweets
unfiltered, Ron Perlman unfiltered.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Yeah, you came to Twitter fairly late in the day. Was that something?
Yeah,
a couple of years.
Yeah,
was it something that you looked upon initially with maybe a little bit of distrust, a little bit of suspicion?
Not nearly as much of distrust and disdain as I look at it now that I'm a member.
What you're gonna say is you're looking at us.
Yeah, no, but I mean it's a slippery slope. Shit, man.
In what way?
Well, if you actually have an opinion about anything, you're going to get 50 haters and 50 lovers every single time. As long as you keep it show busy and, hey, I'm in this, come see me, then it's like, the big cosmic blowjob. But, you say anything about Obama or, the GOP or something like that, which I'm kind of a political junkie. So I open my big fucking mouth where I shouldn't. And it's you better be ready.
Yeah.
Because the hate's going to come.
The hate is going to come.
I'm guessing the question you get most from people on Twitter is, Hellboy 3. Where's Hellboy 3? When's it coming?
Well, I was the one who actually, opened
up.
I opened that door. So, I deserve to get, to have to feel that question. But just finally had dinner with Guillermo del Toro, who's such an old dear friend, but we hadn't seen each other in a long time because he's busy and I'm busy and blah, blah, blah. And I've been doing this thing, where I've been taunting him to like, come on, motherfucker, let's do this shit, man. I'm standing here. I ain't getting no younger. And so finally we had dinner and I thought he was going to shoot me, but he ended up being quite amused by this whole thing. And by the end of the dinner, we made a pact that, whatever happens with Hellboy 3, if he does it, I do it. If he doesn't do it, I don't do it. Yeah. So that's where it sits right now.
But you must love the character, because that's an arduous process to get into the Hellboy costume and now, prosthetics and stuff.
I really feel as though I'm done with the character. I don't have a burning desire to put that shit on again. But I do feel as... I mean, Guillermo told me what the resolve to the trilogy would kind of look like in broad strokes. And it's such an amazingly theatrical, cinematic idea that I found it to be essential that we do it. Like, and not only that, but we kind of... We were designed to be a trilogy with a beginning, a middle, and an end. And, we've only done two-thirds. So I feel kind of... We're really not done till we finish it.
Can you give us a one-word hint of what that third installment, the flavor of it?
I can give you a two-word hyphen.
One finger.
Fucked up.
The X-rated Hellboy.
Because the end of Hellboy 2.
That's almost one word.
Yeah. The end of Hellboy 2 is so lovely. Like gorgeous freeze frame. He's just learned he's going to be the father of twins.
And yeah. Then the notion of I'll tell you this, The two twins were gonna, like, one would be look like the mom and one would look like the dad, and which one was, and but the, one of them was gonna be completely fucking corrupt and the other one was gonna be angelic.
Yeah.
Which one was which? No, only Guillermo would make the fucked up looking one be the angel. So then there's that adds to this saga of like, holy shit, he's the beast of the apocalypse. He has to take down civilization. He has to. It's non-negotiable. Yeah. And so that's the foundation for the story. And that's what I think. Like, it'd be a shame if we don't do it.
Right back when he was talking about doing The Hobbit, he mentioned that he had a part in mind for you.
Yeah.
Can you say anything about that now that all those films?
Yeah. No. It was the bear. The guy who was the bear.
Right. Bjorn.
Bjorn. Yeah. When he was no longer a part of it, I became no longer a part of it. By choice, because I wouldn't have been even in the conversation if it weren't for Guillermo.
You hadn't started your bear exercises, and
no, I hadn't bared anything yet.
We do this thing with guests on the podcast.
Oh, no, really?
Don't worry, it's not that bad. It's called the IMDb Bunker. So there's a lot of trivia about actors on the IMDb.
You bet there is.
90% of it's not true. So we just want to run past some things with you, see what's true and what's not.
Go ahead.
So it says here that...
Untrue. I'm not even Ron Perlman.
You're Ronald Perlman.
I haven't been myself lately.
Early in his career, he tried doing stand-up comedy.
True.
True. Fantastic.
Not so much. That's why I became an actor.
What was your routine?
I stole.
You stole?
I stole, yeah. I stole, and I mainly stole from George Carlin, who was obscure enough when I was doing stand-up that no one would have caught me. It was almost like my version of, you know, trying to be Burt Lancaster on my Miami Vice, but people caught on. They said, wait a minute, he's doing George Carlin's routine, like word for word.
Did you ever have a Larry David experience where you came out and just looked at the audience and then just went off again? Did you sense it wasn't right?
I never in my life had a Larry David moment. Except maybe on the golf course, because probably we both suck.
You're well known, obviously, for your extensive body of work with acting under prosthetics. That is true. We know that. You've given many actors like Armin Shimerman and Michael Chiklis advice on how to emote effectively under full head prosthetics. Is this true?
Semi-true.
Okay. In what way?
One of them.
Which one?
No, actually, I you know, I did give both of them my version of the prosthetic thing. Uh-huh. But it had more to do with medication than actual acting advice, you know. I said, you're going to want some preparation H because you're going to be sitting in a chair for long periods of time.
This is good stand-up. You don't need to steal anything.
See, I could have been material. A contender. I could have been somebody.
Is it true that your favorite movie of all time is Nobody's Fool?
It is among my favorites.
Right.
I mean, it's definitely in the top 50. I mean, my favorite movie of all time is The Godfather Part 1. But Nobody's Fool is emblematic of a movie that's quiet, purely character study, no plot, very little happens in the movie, and yet you just cannot, you don't want it to end.
And the last one before we let you go, Ron. Bears, this is verbatim from the IMDb, bears such a striking resemblance to singer and actor Tom Waits that once Waits was credited as Perlman on a movie poster. Is that true, and would you know if it was true?
No, I don't know whether that's true or not. I don't, but I do know that I did a movie in Paris for 6 months where I was living in Paris, and I was recognized on the street 26 times, and 24 of them they thought I was Tom Waits. One guy thought I was a guy I never heard of, and then there was one person that said, hey, you're Ron Perlman. But out of 26 times, 24 thought I was Tom Waits. And one woman chased me. I said, no, I'm not Tom Waits. She says, fuck you! Why do you say you're not Tom Waits? If I were Tom Waits, I would be so proud of it. And I went, yeah, and me too. I'm telling you, I love the guy. I'm a fan, but I'm not him. Fuck you!
That's amazing.
Fucking American.
Which means I have to ask, have you met Tom Waits?
We have met. Not nearly as, enough for my liking. This is a motherfucker I would really like to get down. We actually talked at one point about playing brothers in a movie.
Wow.
Because it's pretty obvious that, you know. And we weren't able to get a script that we both agreed on. But that's on the bucket list. Just so that I could, you know, have lunch with him every day. You know,
so,
have catered set food. And talk about shit, you know. Talk about shit.
That would be amazing. So a film with you, Stephen Lang, and J.K. Simmons, and then the film with you and Tom Waits as brothers.
Yeah.
If you take nothing else from this podcast, please take those two ideas and make them a reality.
I'd like to take the financing along with it. How is Empire doing these
look
days?
Look around you. There is no financing here.
I guess it's going to be a real low budget.
We'll shoot it in here.
We'll get a Kickstarter going. Ron Perlman, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Pleasure's been mine.
Can I just say, when I was at the bar, when I was a barrister,
Oh, yeah. Which bar?
We used to make jokes about Judge John Deeds. Do you remember that TV show? Which had a judge who frequently would decide cases fought by his ex-wife and his lover, or his wife and his daughter and things like that.
Wouldn't that be allowed?
That wouldn't really be encouraged, no. Okay. And also he would do things like go off and interview witnesses and members of the jury and stuff on his own, which again, not encouraged.
But not ruled out completely?
No, ruled out completely, pretty much. Okay. People used to just come into chambers every morning and just laugh at that. Like, did you see what he did last night? I feel there's a risk that this new series, despite the awesome Ron Perlman, will receive the same greeting from actual lawyers. Did you see the bit where the judge turned vigilante?
Well, it could happen.
I mean, it seems unlikely. I've met a few more judges than you, I would guess, Chris.
I think I've met a few more vigilantes than you.
All right, then. Agree to disagree.
And they're all lovely people. Mm. Brian, if you're listening,
please don't kill me.
Let's meet for bridge at the weekend.
There's a court show on ITV called Judge Reinder. I got an email from Judge Reinhold, I'm not even kidding, about 3 or 4 months ago, just telling me he'd love that show and he wanted me to tweet about it. So there we go.
Awesome.
Watch Judge Reinder.
Nick, of course, one of your finest hours at Empire was finally making Judge Not Lest Ye Be Judged by Judge Reinhold a thing.
This is true, yeah, in which Judge Reinhold turns the tables on his critics by criticising or critiquing their reviews of his films. Mm-hmm. And I finally made it happen. It took years.
It took years, but it was very good. Two things I really wanted to do along those lines have never quite happened. I've always wanted to do Listen to Your Friend Billy Sane, which is an agony uncle column in which Billy Sane solves the problems of Empire readers. That's never quite got past his people. The other thing that's never quite got past people's people, so to speak, is Mr. Bean's Holiday, in which we take Sean Bean to Brighton for the day and film him on the rides and having an ice cream and with his trouser rolled up around his ankles. And we print it in the magazine as if he's having a lovely time.
It's weird that he wouldn't want to do that, isn't it?
You get a free trip to Brighton.
Didn't you at one point switch your attention to Michael Bean?
Yes.
And try and make it happen with him too.
Even though it was spelled differently.
Yeah.
Both would be equally terrifying. You're having a great time, aren't you, Sean? No.
An article based on a pun based on a Mr. Bean sequel.
Yep.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Finest hour. Yep. Sean, if you're listening, and I know you are, can we please do that? And similarly, Billy Sane, call me 0800 Hewitt Chat. That's the number. Let's make it happen. Right, let's have some movie news now. What do you want to talk about? Let's talk about things.
Yeah, I feel like we should get the big story for you out of the way, Chris. And that is Jack Reacher 2.
Oh my God.
Autumn 2016, only a year to go, well, a year and a month, Jack Reacher's sequel is set for an October release in the US, October 21st to be exact, with Ed Zwick taking over writing and directing duties from Christopher McQuarrie. Tom Cruise, of course, back.
Back.
And this one is going to be based Never Go Back, as we discussed last week.
Never Go Back.
Indeed.
Yes, I'm excited. It's opening in the US on the same day as Ouija 2. And Underworld 5, guys, vacate that day. That's Reacher Day. And no matter what the quality of the finished film, I'll be in the cinemas paying to see it 30 times in a row.
Of course.
So, obviously, because it's Reacher. And that's what he would want.
Yeah.
So.
Well, he'd say nothing, but that's what he'd want.
See, he says a lot. He does say a lot.
There were so many. I just finished reading the most recent Jack Reacher novel, which is spectacularly titled Make Me.
Make Me. Which is the title of which was revealed exclusively on this podcast to us by Lee Child.
And there are so many times where it says Reacher said nothing that I'm starting to think it's turning into the Damn It thing from 24, where they're deliberately putting them in, like there's some kind of drinking game happening.
Hewitt said nothing.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. It's a fun book, that, until it gets really, really dark and twisted.
It got super dark in the last 30 pages out of nowhere. Yeah, it was quite depressing.
I like the super dark.
Good. I mean, a good super darkness, but still, like, super dark.
Mm. Mm.
Anyway.
Oh, tell me the title of that book again.
Make Me.
Oh, for God's sake, Helen. Look, I just want to know the title of a new Reacher book. Can you just tell me it, please?
Who's on first, Chris?
What just happened? Yeah, I'm very excited about that. Ding! Nick, what's on your movie newsometer?
Born 5. Or is it Born 4?
Mm.
Or is it Born 6? Right, it's definitely not Born 6. But the latest Paul Greengrass, Matt Damon movie, which I believe has just started shooting or is about to start shooting on Monday, now has a villain. Tommy Lee Jones has already been confirmed that he's going to be in it, presumably chasing Bourne around Europe. But now Vincent Cassell has been confirmed as well as another baddie, if Tommy Lee Jones is a baddie. And Matt Damon has also said a couple of things about the film. He said, talked about how it's going to start in Greece and it's kind of an austerity thriller.
We do know that Paul Greengrass likes a political subtext or indeed text. So that's rather exciting.
Yeah, I'm excited about this.
I mean, Vincent Cassell is one of those guys who is really, really good as a villain. And he almost works sometimes where, as a red herring, just by putting him in the film, you think he's going to be the villain. And if he turns out to do anything other than mass murder, you're surprised. It's almost a twist. So I think casting him as your bad guy is probably a good move. And a nice kind of contrast physically and in terms of kind of energy to Tommy Lee Jones. So if he's got these two very different guys kind of after him, then I think that's an interesting setup.
I'm very curious about this one. Is Jeremy Renner going to turn up?
I would doubt it.
You never know. Because if he appears on screen and goes, "Hey guys, it's me, Jeremy Renner," then everyone would go, What? Who?
He might just be in the background.
He might be in the background
of one shot blowing up a wolf.
They might go, "Oh my God, Aaron Cross is still in the loose." And everyone goes, Who's Aaron Cross? What's happening?
I'm going to take some meds. That's really bummed me out.
But still, very, very exciting times. I'm intrigued by something I saw today, which was the first pic has been revealed of Bryan Cranston as LBJ, Lyndon B. Johnson, in an HBO movie called All Away, which is based on the Broadway play for which Cranston won a Tony fairly recently. Now, one of the reasons I'm intrigued by this is that it's directed by Jay Roach. And Jay Roach directed Trumbo, which also stars Bryan Cranston as the screenwriter Dalton Trumbo, who was blacklisted during McCarthyism, of course, and he wrote loads of scripts under pseudonyms and whatnot, and his life's very, very interesting. But it's a Jay Roach thing that it intrigues me. Because if you look at Jay Roach's filmography, it's the Austin Powers trilogy.
Yeah.
It's the first two Meet the Parents movies. It's The Campaign. It's Dinner with Schmucks. And Mystery Alaska, which is a very, very fine, small movie. If you've never seen it, it's very good. And then suddenly, somewhere along the way in the last few years, and maybe it was The Campaign that pointed him in a different direction, he's suddenly now become Mr. Worthy Biopic Man. And this is the man who gave his Fat Bastard and Mini-Me. And what's going on?
I mean, we haven't seen the finished product yet. There could be a mini LBJ in there, Chris.
There could be a mini LBJ. We shouldn't leap to conclusions.
I'm so in for that. That's amazing. With a tiny desk.
Why is it called All the Way and not Lyndon B. Johnson, International President of Mystery? What's going on?
I really want there to be a mini president there.
We have to allow people their career changes, Chris. Come now. But yeah, I mean, Cranston looks great, so fingers crossed for that one.
I'm not saying he's going to be bad. I'm intrigued, and I think it shows it's inspirational that you can get out of the ghetto. You know, in a way, the ghettoization of your career, if you are cordoned off and you can only do comedy or you can only do horror, then Jay Roach is showing you the way. Attica, Attica!
Well done, him. Speaking of people who escaped the ghetto they were put in, sort of, it's a segue. Kenneth Branagh has got his new directing job lined up.
He has escaped a ghetto, I put
he
him
has.
In.
Last, yeah. God. He's very sneaky, Branagh.
He is.
Very sneaky.
It's not a ghetto, more of a dungeon. I spent ages on it.
You were trying to persuade him, of course, Chris, to direct Thor Ragnarok for Marvel. But in fact, he's gone elsewhere in Disney. After the enormous success of Cinderella, he can pretty much, you know, choose whatever the heck he wants. And it seems that he is going to develop and potentially direct the Artemis Fowl adaptation. Now, these books are huge. They're among a slightly younger crowd than us, I think it's fair to say. They are aimed at, you know, young teens and sort of tweens.
Have you read them?
I have read the first one. I've read the whole set. I think there's seven of them altogether. Okay. And Artemis Fowl is a child criminal mastermind, which is immediately quite fun. And he kidnaps a fairy in the hopes of extracting the secrets of fairy gold from them, and things don't go quite according to plan. So that's the basic setup of the first book.
It's not a chicken. I don't know anything about this. My first image was a chicken who's a spy.
Right, it's not a chicken who's a spy.
I'm really disappointed.
It's a small boy who's a criminal.
Well, we don't know what might happen in the development process.
I mean, you can keep hoping for that. Funny enough, somebody was pointing out on Twitter that the cover of the book actually portrays a kid who looks exactly like the boy who plays the young Bruce Wayne in Gotham. So if they're just going off similarity to...
Which they should do.
Nothing else should come into it, really. That's who they should cast. But that's the kind of kid we're talking about. So it could be really good. And it could be another sort of big young person series. So it'll be interesting to see what Brenna does with that one.
Fantastic. Happy days. Isn't there a Lemony Snicket TV show coming up?
There is. Netflix. I'm super excited. I love Lemony Snicket. I bang on about it all the time. The movie Jim Carrey was very good as Count Olaf.
It was, yeah.
The rest of it wasn't that good.
No. But...
And I wish there was more. So I'm excited about that.
I think it will actually suit the TV format better, potentially. Mm. Although the unrelenting grimness may be quite fun to see.
It's super grim.
It's super unfortunate. Grim.
It's super unfortunate. Maximum snickety.
Maximum snickety. I'm looking forward to it very, very much indeed.
And one more thing we should quickly mention is Cate Blanchett is potentially going to star in a biopic of Lucille Ball. And this is exciting because Aaron Sorkin is writing the script. And that is just a combination of people that I would never have put together. Particularly. Now, Lucille Ball, I mean, the idea of having a biopic of her is actually a really good one because she was an enormously powerful TV force. Her show was like the biggest thing on TV for, what, 10, 20 years. Huge, huge success. She studied acting back in the day, I think I'm right in saying, with Bette Davis. So she, you know, she went a long way back on Broadway and in film before she got into TV, but it was there that she really made her mark. And it's a really interesting kind of story. And Aaron Sorkin and Cate Blanchett. Weird mix of people, but I'm kind of intrigued by it.
Good mix of people.
Very good.
So, yeah. So there's no director yet?
There's no director yet. No, they're sort of putting together a package that I guess they can sort of take out to people. Mm. Shop to directors, as I believe the saying goes. But I wouldn't imagine that Cate Blanchett would have a heck of a lot of trouble of finding somebody good.
If this movie's a biopic, right? Mm-hmm. Movies about people are biopics. Real people are biopics. Does that mean the Babe movies are biopics? That happened. One more thing before we talk about the very, very sad news that happened this week, Helen.
Well, Tatiana Maslany, who's the star of Orphan Black, who gives not just one great performance in that show, but about 16, is apparently in the running. She's going through the auditioning process for Star Wars Episode 8.
To play all the other characters?
I assume so, because quite frankly, you could save a lot of money just getting her to do everything. She is one of the contenders. There's a shortlist which contains Gina Rodriguez, who's the star of Jane the Virgin, who's going to be seen soon in Deepwater Horizon. Mm-hmm. Olivia Cooke is also in there. And they apparently all have appointments for, and I quote, a chemistry read with an actor who appears in episode 7.
Yes.
You can read our story where we have named name.
Olivia Cooke is from Me and Elle and the Dying Girl.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. Which we're going to be talking about in due course, and I will be gushing about it in due course. And then the saddest news this week, the awful, tragic death of Wes Craven, who passed away at the age of 76 following a brief battle with brain cancer. Wes Craven was, for me, one of the horror filmmakers who shaped my love of the genre. Yeah. One of the big four, you know, Cronenberg, Romero, Carpenter and Craven. And he's the first one of that quartet to go. The rest are not allowed to die. This is my I'm saying it right now. Sorry guys, you gotta hang around. But Wes Craven, I mean, where do you begin? The man was extraordinary. Last House on the Left, The Hills Have Eyes, A Nightmare on Elm Street, Wes Craven's New Nightmare, the Scream franchise, which, as Kim Newman said in a tweet earlier this week, which I think nailed it better than anyone else could. Wes Craven reinvented horror four times. Most directors don't even get to manage it once. And, you know, I haven't even mentioned The People Under the Stairs or The Serpent in the Rainbow or Shocker. Which
you introduced me to.
I introduced you to Shocker.
My love of Mitch Pileggi and his finest cinematic hour. She's saying something.
But well, I think that probably speaks more to the lack of cinematic hours for Mitch Pileggi than...
You shut up.
But Shocker is a lot of fun.
But Wes Craven had a fascinating career. He was an English and psychology professor. He got into hardcore porn. He was editing porn for a while. And then obviously his movie career took off. But Last House on the Left was his first one, wasn't it?
And it's, you know, that's a very, very hardcore film as well. No Holds Barred. It's a very grim film, very grueling film. Pretty much all his early work was really, really gruesome. The Hills of Eyes is very, very dark.
And so many just moments that stay with you. There's shots and there's deaths in the Nightmare on Elm Street series that absolutely will not shake. Those will be in your head forever.
The bathtub scene.
The bit on the ceiling. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
There were things he came back to throughout his career. The bathtub scene in Nightmare on Elm Street actually echoes a previous scene in a film he made, which not many people have seen, called Deadly Blessing, which stars Ernest Borgnine and a very young Sharon Stone, and has an ending I've never forgotten. The film itself is not very good, but the ending is fantastic. And there's a moment in the bathtub, the main character goes to have a bath, and a snake gets, because someone lets a snake into the bath there, and it's like, what he was really good at was, because he was a psychologist, and he knew
but people feared, and he was very, very good at digging into that sort of primal jelly at the back of your brain and tickling it a little bit.
Kind of finding the situations you normally feel very safe in and then giving it a dark twist.
Yeah.
He directed a TV movie about a spa that had a portal to hell, which is why I didn't go to spas. Also, they were a bit too expensive.
I don't go to hell either.
Yeah.
For the same reason.
But he was also, by all accounts, a gentleman of it, as well as all this dark stuff. He was into bird watching. And I was reading some of his columns. You can go online and read his articles about birds and bird watching. And they're really nice and funny.
Yeah, he was great. I interviewed him a couple of times. I think the last time I spoke to him was either for Issue 200 or it was for Red Eye, his very solid thriller from 2005. And he was great, and he endured all my stupid questions about Freddy Krueger. But yeah, phenomenal. I mean, Nightmare on Elm Street looms large. And even though he left the franchise after that, he came back to co-write Nightmare on Elm Street 3, and then obviously New Nightmare, which was great and paved the way for Scream, which was a very, very meta take on horror. Mm. But Scream is fantastic. I love Scream 2. Scream 2 is great.
Yeah, absolutely brilliant film.
We did a Scream-a-thon, didn't we, a few years ago?
We did Scream and Scream 2. We stopped before Scream 3. Scream 4 I like as well. I think it's underrated.
That's one with Shaun of the Dead reference. Yeah. Edgar Wright wrote a very, very nice kind of tribute to him and mentioned that he kind of got in touch with him briefly because he wanted to do a reference to Shaun of the Dead.
No, it's always fantastic. It's great to see when, you know, the upside of people passing away like this is the outpouring of love that hits social media soon afterwards. And, you know, it felt very heartfelt for Wes Craven, indeed.
It did.
There's some lovely things I've seen this week. And he was great. The last communication we had with him, weirdly enough, was we asked him to come on the podcast. He was in London a few months ago. And I DM'd him from the Empire account because he followed Empire on Twitter and said, "Oh, you're in London. Would you like to come on our podcast?" And he went, "It's a flying visit. I'm literally leaving today. I'll be back. I'll do it next time." Mm. And that was the last we heard of him. But he was a true great. Wes Craven, who passed away this week. Okay, let's have our second guest now on the podcast. Legend, which is out next week, is out on Wednesday, tells the story of Ronnie and Reggie Cray, notorious Cray twins who ruled London's criminal circle with fists of iron in the 60s before it all unraveled badly for them. Brian Helgeland is the Oscar-winning writer of LA Confidential. He writes and directs the movie, and I went along and spoke to him this week, along with the young up-and-coming actor who plays both Crays, Tom Hardy. Enjoy.
Delighted to be joined on the Empire podcast by Brian Helgeland. Tom Hardy, how are you guys?
Good, thank you.
Good, how are you? At the same time as you. Do you know what you're at then?
No one will know who said that.
We're both good.
Excellent. That's good to hear. Tom, I noticed you were talking about Woody, your dog, beforehand. You caused quite the stir the other week bringing Woody to
the
screen.
Woody caused quite the stir the other week, to be fair. Yeah.
Woody was a big star on Twitter for a while.
Yeah, he was. Yeah. He was. Bless him. Yeah, he's coming out tonight. He'll be wearing Alexander McQueen.
Doing the red carpet.
Yeah, he will. Yeah.
Usual stuff. That's fantastic.
I've been around Woody a lot because he shot with us. Uh-huh. And I've never seen him lose his dignity like that before.
What, wearing Alexander McQueen?
No, laying on his back.
I was going to say,
at the screening, yeah.
He played out, didn't he, to the crowd? It was great. I think you saw a room full of, like, potential sausages.
Yeah.
So he gave them what they wanted.
He's got a biscuit, yeah.
It's amazing. I want to take you guys back to the time you first met, which was a dinner to talk about this film. And Brian, you went in hoping that Tom might say yes to one or both roles.
Yeah, well, I didn't have it in my head how to proceed, but I knew Reggie was the lead of the two. So start out by nailing down Reggie and not knowing if Tom would even want to play both parts. So
okay.
Had to kind of take it one step at a time. Mm. And then he obviously had responded to Ron, so that was the start of it.
What were your recollections, Tom? Did you go into that thinking, I'm going to do this, but I want to play both parts, or how did it come about for you?
I wanted to play the Krays for years, for a long, long time, but I never thought it would come up. And for it to come up through Working Title was really, I knew that they were going to make a film. It wasn't going to be salacious or anything like that, and that it would be taken seriously, and it was going to be a good piece of work to get involved with. So when it popped up in the ether that the Krays, there was a script about the Krays and knocking about through Working Title, and then it was Brian who'd written LA Confidential and he was directing, those components immediately, as an actor, made me want it no matter what. The question was, did I want to just play Reggie? And I wasn't really feeling that as much as when I was reading the script, I was enjoying the Ronnie character.
Yeah.
And then, but I didn't want to lose either of them. But if I had to make a, on the day, if I could choose one and only one, then I probably would have chosen Ron.
Right.
And Brian was corralling for Reggie. So
right.
We had to dinner. And ultimately, it came down the line as, you know.
It's that old candy commercial. You got chocolate on my peanut butter. No, you got peanut butter on my chocolate.
Yeah,
you got Reggie on my Ron.
Yeah, yeah. You gave me both.
Yeah.
So was it a tough negotiation over that dinner?
No. It was. But it's funny because you make that decision at the end of dinner, and to me, the movie's now
fucked
or not. If it doesn't work,
it's fucked.
Yeah.
So
all the 6 months of hard work that's about to come is going to be a complete waste of time.
Yeah, also. Yeah.
It's like snatch and grab, and the road suddenly gets narrower.
Yeah,
doesn't it? The tightrope begins.
So, yeah.
Yeah. At the same time, it gives the film the discipline. Because I think a film needs a discipline applied to it. So it became, how do we do it, and how do we make it go away?
I mean, you told me something, because I've spoken to you before about this movie, Brian, that you felt, and Tom, maybe you can weigh in on this, that you felt that the Ronnie part was the prize for you, and that you did Reggie in a way, and Reggie was a great part for you as well, but you rewarded yourself as well with the Ronnie part. That was the real meat for you.
Treated myself.
Treated you. I think that was the phrase you used. You treated yourself in a way to Ronnie.
Yeah, because Reggie's straighter and more classic, and I think the kind of part that Tom's shied away from a bit, in that it's not as interesting as an actor.
Yeah, you've got a point there. I mean, there is an element of the straight lead that I've always wanted to kind of avoid, because they're not normally very interesting. They're very handsome and beautiful or whatever, but that's kind of where the buck stops, and stuff happens to them, and they inevitably accomplish a task, and at the end of the movie we all know they're going to win or whatever. So it's kind of a bit dull. But to be fair with Reggie, there's a character lead, so it's not,
yeah,
it's a leading part with character. So there's no bells and whistles on the ego side of it, is you can't really get all your trinkets out and your dressing up box and sort of enjoy an immersive sort of clown experience in the truest sense of clown, and sending things up or playing with the flop or the air of anything can go wrong at any given moment that you can with a larger character like Ron, who has, you know, much more of a tightrope in active and reactive behaviour. But I think what was soon very clear to me as a challenge that I wanted as an actor, and there's plenty of actors and actresses who have done it before, but I wanted to do, for me in the training, was to play one character but with two heads, you know, the two sides of a similar coin, and then having individual silhouettes which were iconic, so that we had to tailor them to very specific pre-existing research materials, primary sources,
right,
you know, such as photographs and
footage
and stuff. So there was boundaries to it which were strict and orthodox, and yet room to play. Ronnie gives more room to play, but also then it gives me an opportunity to earth him against Reggie, so the two were one, if that makes sense.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's a good answer.
That's a great answer.
I mean, I think it also benefits from one actor, because the negotiation is in your own head, as far as, and because they are brothers and would have been close and would have thought, some things would have been very similar about them, and rather than two actors trying to find that middle ground or, you know, compromise sometimes as to how they're approaching it, I think it all being in one actor's head, it benefited from that as well.
Well, there's a cohesion, isn't there? The thing is, then you have to, like, a natural cohesion with the self, which is definitely there, in the same way that if you had two real brothers or twins playing it, there's a similarity that you get further away from when you have two different actors.
I know for that reason as well, you didn't shy away completely, because you had to, in some occasions, use face replacement and body double. Very rarely, though,
just
but
for the
most part.
Some of the action, face replacement, just because the frame couldn't avoid it, but very little.
Mm. But in that case, Tom, as well, it was Jacob Tamuri, wasn't it, who was the...
Jacob Tamuri is the unsung Cray brother, both Ronnie and Reggie, who, you know, again, he played both parts as much as I did. In fact, he had to do the work twice as hard, because he was mimicking everything and then predicting what I'd do by the afternoon as well.
Right.
So we'd forge a line at the top of the day to say, look, this is the path of least resistance, so if all else fails, we'll go back to this basic dynamic, and this is how we're going to play the scene. but be open for any opportunities that we can have in order to blur that line between the two to make it more realistic that we're in the room. So
he'd
have to play default to the line from what he'd learned in the morning, about 15 minutes, you know. We'd record both characters' dialogue in the morning. We all had earpieces in, all the cast that were in the room with the two brothers, and Jacob had an earpiece in. And what that would do would play the lines that I'd recorded that morning that the other brother would be saying. So when I was on set playing one of the brothers, I would be speaking loud, and then there'd be a silence where Jacob would be miming to a recorded version of the answer in his ear that I could cut off, so we could record real life sound as well.
Wow.
So it was kind of, you know, and Jacob held it all together incredibly well.
Yeah.
For somebody who, you know, had only signed up to deliver a pizza.
Yeah.
Really, you know, many aspects. It was the hardest job of my career. And I thought, you know what, I'll just throw Tamuri under the bus because he's a stuntman. So metaphorically, he went under that bus and he came up smelling of roses. He's now got a part in playing a Sherpa on going up to Everest.
Oh, cool.
Amazing.
Yeah, his first leading role.
The most amazing thing to my eyes was, because we're shooting overs onto Reggie, so we're shooting over Ron onto Reggie. So Jacob would, and Tom would have to work out his physicality of Ron before he actually shot as Ron,
right?
And teach that physicality to Jacob, so Jacob had to reproduce it before Tom did it, in a sense.
But it had to be open to differentiation. So we had to choose specific positionings for hands or shoulder so that I could then move should I see something in the room, or should I learn something from playing Reggie in that morning that I can then react to as Ronnie in the afternoon. So you had to find ready positions, so like put your hand here so that I can move it to there in the afternoon if I want to,
because otherwise the overs wouldn't work when we cut.
I just have his hands down for the whole scene and it wouldn't be, there would be no interaction. So you have to predict interaction physically
oh my god,
as opposed to react in the moment. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. So how the hell did you do the fight scene?
No idea. It's just like, no idea.
Movie magic.
We slapped each other senseless for real. The best thing you can do, like really, is illusion. And to create an illusion is to cover a man's face.
Yeah.
That will help. So instead of having a boxing match, and I think it adds to the stories that these guys were great boxers, etc. We always hear about how tough they are, but let's, you know, when you have, you know, a cat fight between two women, or let's say, or two sisters, or imagine that we sort of extrapolated that concept of two people having a really angry spat with one another, but not trying to hurt each other in a gung-ho, brutal boxing type of way. So slap boxing is incredibly painful, and you can really intend, you know, you can give a lot of intention with a slap, but there's less damage you can do than a punch. We went for a sort of massive slap boxing fest, which also hides the face quite well. So there's a good side to it, is you can go really hard at slap boxing, and you know you won't hurt each other too much, so we can do plenty of slapping, which we did. Bad side was is that Ronnie wears a lot of rings. a lot of rings and a lot of jewelry. So, you know, it was all right when I was playing Ronnie, but then when I had to switch around to play Reggie, and Ronnie does hit a little bit harder and out of control than Reggie in the way that we stylized it, I had to receive a plentiful amount of brass at the receiving end, you know, and anything I laid down, I had also to receive.
Oh my God!
Jacob went to we got stitches, didn't he?
And
I got a black eye. And
when I come to the editing room in the morning, and the editor had said, "You got to see this one," and we'd step through the frames and see the face compress as the hand hit the face and all those things.
I mean, can you not use? I mean, it's a bit late now, obviously, but rubber rings and stuff like that.
Yeah, rings.
Rubber
never
rings.
Occurred to me.
What's a rubber ring?
I don't know. It's a ring made of rubber, I'm guessing.
What would that do? No, forget it. It would never have had the impact. And another thing is we know we're going to hit each other hard. So there's an energy between, because Jacob and I are very close. It's how far do you want to push it? And there was a couple of moments where we pushed it. It's probably a little bit too far. And they're in the film.
Yeah.
Apart from one, do you remember when he dipped? He ducked and I was supposed to hit Charlie from behind.
Right.
But he just hit me a little bit too hard before, and I zeroed in. And as he ducked, I just cracked him straight square on the top of the head.
Yeah.
And it was a beautiful punch.
Yeah.
But totally unnecessary. But it was like, I said, all right, Jacob, let's rewind that. Look at it. Look at me. Look at me. I sparked you, mate. I mean, so can't use it. But it was a good hit.
DVD, Brian? Put it on the DVD.
Yeah, we'll do them all, cut them all together in one long loop.
Poor old Jakey.
That'd be amazing.
Yeah, he was great.
He's awesome, Jake. Yeah, and he even came up with the pretzel line, didn't he?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I bent him up like a pretzel. I really hurt him. It's like, where did that come from? We created a monster with Jakey, didn't we? So that started out as not really into acting, and by the end of it, he was, you know, Strasbourg.
Yeah.
Still at Adler.
That's amazing. Brian, I'm not going to throw things that you've said to me back at you all the time, but there's one more thing you said to me, which I thought was fantastic, which was that when you, Tom, were playing Reggie, Ronnie, that you would come up to Brian and go, so what are we doing today? What are we shooting? Okay, that's fine. Brilliant. No worries. But when you were Reggie, you'd come up to him and be sort of questioning the shot choice and questioning what Brian was doing as a director. Be slightly a little bit more antagonistic. Is that?
Yeah. Well, no,
is that apprehensive, right?
Yeah. Ron was much more open and you knew where you stood with him. Mm. And not that you didn't know with Reggie, but Reggie, I always felt, was how Reggie probably was in real life, a little bit more slow to warm up to things and wanting to understand what was going on, not wanting to be at anyone's mercy, so to speak, and just wanting to understand what was going on in the room and to then take his place in it.
It was much more apprehensive playing Reggie. It was a lot more, it was a lot closer to me, I think, Reggie, as well, and I don't like playing me. I mean, there was an accent there, which isn't mine, and there's, you know, there's a costume and a silhouette and all that sort of stuff, but it was getting a bit close to using me, and I don't like doing that at all. Whereas Ronnie just doesn't give a fuck, does he? You're coming to do what he wants. And that's, as a performer, that's like brilliant.
And it was all good, but the set was more serious around Reg. The set when Ron was there was a party.
Because I was on set, actually, for a scene where you were playing Ron.
Oh, yeah.
And you were improvising. It was a scene where you ask Jack the Hat to kill Leslie Payne.
Oh, yeah. Okay. We were sat in the booth and I was howling.
We with Taron. It was fantastic.
Oh, and with Charlie Merkel. Yeah. And I was trying to explain to him how to do it properly. And I kept corpsing. So unprofessional. But I did enjoy playing Ronnie. You can say anything as Ronnie.
Yeah.
Like, you can actually say anything. I mean, talking about these people as if they're not real.
Yeah.
Within the constraint of this particular production and you know, take on the twins as a, you know, as a story piece in itself, separate from the real guys. When playing Ronnie as a mask, it was definitely a pleasure to be able to have the freedom of the rug puller. No, you can rug pull everybody at any time, including the focus puller, right down to, you know, whoever's on costume or whoever the new boy is. They're all getting it.
Yeah, but it was a great, whoever was opposite him at the time, it was a great separator of the men from the boys when Tom would, during a take, Tom would change things up and if they could roll with him or not. It was so much fun to watch. You'd see guys get flustered. Other guys would just
go with
hang
him
in there.
Yeah, totally. You know,
like the tea scene. That guy just...
Oh, Stephen Lord.
He's Stephen Lord.
Awesome, yeah.
And the first time when we hadn't rehearsed it this way, but we start rolling and Tom just gets in 2 inches away from him. And when I'm watching it, I'm like, what's Steve going to do? And he was just... He just rolled with it. It was so great.
Yeah, Stephen's an awesome actor.
Yeah.
And some people come alive to that. Because it's quite an oppressive nature to have an actor in your face with that kind of camouflage going on. Because there's only one way it can go, and Ronnie wins. He doesn't lose. How's he going to win?
Yeah.
And his duplicity, his means are just so direct, but they're laterals as well. He's quite off the wall character in that aspect. So he's a lot of free rein to say the unsayable and the unspeakable in a brutal honesty. It comes with him, which is really quite pure. In performance, it's a really nice camouflage to have.
Speaking of camouflage, I mean, Ron's voice is fantastic. Where did that come from for you? Was that?
Initially, there's some BBC footage about a minute long of the lads being the twins being interviewed just post getting off. I think they got off a court case
for the McCowan case. Yeah,
and it's very hard to ascertain whether or not they were that was their true voice or not.
Yeah.
Because they're on screen and they're being interviewed, so, and their lawyers there and stuff like that. But there was a Reggie kind of voice like that, which is you couldn't really put it on a film, you know. And Ron's was very much like that, actually. You know, it was a little bit higher, but it's again something you couldn't put on a film, and it wouldn't have landed. So the voice for Ron, which we took the hollow sound of Ron's sound, and made it fuller, more of a bass in it. So it's bigger, it's rounder. Do you know what I mean? But it's still from the same source, and but embellished like everything is in in, you know, storytelling. Never let the truth get in the way of
print a legend, even you
like,
know.
And Reggie's went from being like slightly sly and in the back of his throat to like then bringing it forward so that it could be projected. So that's where they came from, and they were born from that, and then brought up a little bit in order to create a vocal silhouette for the pair of them.
I mean, you mentioned right at the beginning you wanted to play the Krays for ages.
I think it was just, it wasn't like I cognitively was like, oh, I want to play the Krays, so I'm going to track it down. It was just in the back of my, I was thinking about it last night. It's like, I've always thought, oh, it would be great if they come up. I think I'd like to have a shot at that. Being a British actor, you go over the some of the people in the past and in history and characters, and that's one from the streets, you know, of the East End. It's a historical classic. And, no, it's like Dickensian, but real. It's like wanting to play Winston Churchill at some point. You know what I mean? In some aspects, for an actor, there's no discrimination between iconography when it comes to like, observing and reflecting primary sources from people who exist. They definitely were on the list of, I'd like, if that pops up, I'd definitely do that, but not with anybody.
Because you know it's going to pop up. You know it's going to get, just like 15 years from now, they'll probably do another version of it.
Oh, yeah, so absolutely.
It's something, like you said, to keep your eye out, because you know eventually someone's going to get around to it.
And someone's going to play all three, aren't they, with Charlie Craig?
That would be interesting. And Brian, when did you first hear about them?
I had heard about them as all good things. It all came through Led Zeppelin. But I had I had been asked to go on tour, on the Page Plant tour, because they were going to make Warner's wanted to make a biopic. And on the second day of the tour, I was told Robert Plant had no interest in it and wouldn't speak to me. So it was kind of a waste of time. But someone associated with the band had a missing finger, and I asked him one day what happened to it. And he held it up, and he said that was the Krays. And I didn't know that he meant people. I thought it was like an animal called a cray had bitten his finger off.
Well, that was the thing to do at the time.
Yeah. Or it was a dance. He got his finger cut on something.
It was a fad. We all cut our fingers off.
Yeah. And he explained,
did they reach the States?
Yeah. And he explained that it was something to do with the music business back in the 60s, and he had gotten on the wrong side of them. And then subsequently, I found out that it was a made-up story. It was a lie.
Yeah.
Which seemed very appropriate that the first thing I ever heard about them wasn't true. And then
so we've continued in that fashion. Just amazing. Like, nothing about them is true, really.
Yeah.
Is it?
Yeah.
And then it was, you know, working title, wanted to do the film, and they came to me, so it went from there.
So the,
it's my theory of everything.
Yeah.
So the Page Plant biopic's not going to happen. Because it's a shame, because I could see Tom.
What's that? The,
I, could, you know, the
I was just about to say, can I do the Led Zeppelin?
Yeah.
That sounds awesome. Yeah. Can I play all of them? Yeah. Lots of beards.
Everyone but John Paul Jones. We got.
We can't play Robert Plant. Robert Plant isn't in it.
Or Jacob's going to be John Paul Jones, I think. The bass
yeah,
player.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
That'd be amazing.
Who'd Panda be?
He'd be
Paul Anderson.
He's the head roadie.
Got to get him in there. Yeah. Sound man.
That'd be amazing. So just a couple of last things. I mean, Tom, you said this is the toughest role of your career?
Technically, yeah.
I mean, given that you spent almost 200 days in the desert driving bits of metal around.
I spent another 800 days in Calgary, didn't I, with in a Ritu,
yeah.
doing the you know, Birdman of Calgary. I mean, the Birdman with a beard and a bear and Leonardo.
So it's saying something that's still...
I'm into epics, yeah. Like, give us a long one. Something longer now, please. It's like, I've done ice. Done ice pigs. I've done red pigs. Now I need something, some space.
Yeah.
Some galaxy pigs.
That would be fun. Are you done with The Revenant? Is that finished for you?
Oh, I'm so done with The Revenant. Absolutely. Love that crew. Love that team. They're awesome. And it went on forever. But that's going to be another epic in the same way that Fury Road was, but in suppose in isolation, and another in the complete opposite of that kind of barrage of chaos and nuttiness and insanity that is the ride of Fury Road. You know, the epic nature of The Revenant is right out there in the wilderness. So it's, you know, huge.
And Brian, have you seen Fury Road? What did you think of that?
Oh no, it's
he hasn't seen it.
You haven't seen Fury Road.
It's blatant.
What Thanks, is going on?
Support is everything. It is key.
It's out on Blu-ray soon. You should
I'll get it for him, don't worry.
I think Tom's fantastic in it.
Cheers, mate.
To be fair, you've got an excuse.
Jacob's fantastic in it.
You were pretty busy the last few months.
When I'm making a movie, I don't watch any. It just doesn't come up.
Right.
Yeah, just
That's a fair one. I don't read scripts. I didn't even read yours.
I did see Warrior, though. I thought, that's the guy.
Yeah.
That's the guy right there.
Okay.
Yeah.
And Tom, I got to ask, so what are Brian's work? Have you seen Payback? LA Confidential?
Yeah, LA Confidential as well, absolutely. Yeah. Hang on. Yeah.
Okay. You should have lied and said no, just to...
No. I've seen everything you script doctored as well, even those we're not allowed to talk about. I'm a huge fan of his script doctoring.
Yeah. It's that old Woody, is it Woody Allen line? I've seen almost all of your films almost all the way through.
I don't know, bombshell. It's a good note in which to end. Brian, Tom, thanks so much.
I want to be the new Bourne.
Thank you. You're in.
That's it. No, we have the power to make that happen.
Yeah.
I want to be the new Bourne.
Done. Sold.
Okay, Legends out next week. We'll talk about it in next week's podcast. Time now to talk about the films that are this week. Time is against us, so we can only really talk about a few. Where should we start?
How about we do Me and Earl and the Dying Girl, because I know you love that.
Yeah, I did say I was going to gush about it earlier on, didn't I? Yes, this is a fantastic film. I think it's not going to be quite everyone's cup of tea, but for me, it's potentially on my list of the 10 of the year. But then again, I've only seen 10 films, so we'll see what happens. But this is a fantastic film directed by Alfonso Gómez-Rejón, who directed The Town of Dread at Sundown. Talking about directors getting out of horror. But this is a wonderfully heartfelt, very funny, very quirky movie. It's based on a young adult novel by Jesse Andrews, who also wrote the screenplay. And it's about a young high school student called Greg, played by Thomas Mann, star of Project X. I knew he'd come good one day. And he is aloof and distant, and he's basically going through high school. He has not allowing anyone to affect him emotionally. He's very cynical. He makes films. He makes spoofs, parodies of classic art house movies. With his best friend Earl, played by R.J. Kyler. And he's not affected really emotionally by anything until a girl in his class, Rachel, played by Olivia Cooke, is diagnosed with leukemia. And his mum, Greg's mum, forces him to befriend her. And he finds himself really not necessarily falling in love. It's not a love story in that sense, but it's certainly a story about someone discovering themselves and discovering the depths of feeling that they can have. And I think this is a fantastic film. It's a fantastic film about love and life and death and about finding yourself as an artist. And I think this movie, for anyone who's been affected by cancer, will particularly have a profound impact on them. I thought it was fantastic. We gave it 4 stars, but I could honestly maybe go and give it the extra 5.
Wow.
Not extra 5 stars.
Yeah, that would be
9 stars.
Nine.
The extra 1 star. 9 stars for me and Earl and Dying Girl.
9 million stars.
Which, as we always say in the podcast, is a recommendation. it's fantastic. The performances are great. Thomas Mann's fantastic. Olivia Cooke, who is from Oldham, but you wouldn't know it from her accent, she's great as well. RJ Kyler, who's a newcomer, is great. And the film is very spryly directed. It's got a lot of heart, a lot of humour. It's really good.
Cool.
Let's talk about Ricky and the Flash.
Yes, Meryl Streep as a rock star, which immediately caught my attention. So this is the story of a woman who essentially abandoned her kids and her marriage years ago when the story starts and moved to LA with dreams of pursuing rock stardom. And she recorded an album, but basically she is playing dive bars with her band, The Flash, and kind of struggling to make ends meet, working in the supermarket by day, that kind of thing. When her daughter, following the breakup of her own marriage, goes through a bit of a traumatic time, she reluctantly goes home to try and help out. And her rather inadequate attempts at comfort are not necessarily well received by her long lost kids, basically. But it's a great, great cast. Mamie Gummer, who is Streep's actual daughter, plays her daughter here. Kevin Kline is her ex-husband. And Rick Springfield, the actual rocker around here, plays the sort of lead guitar in her band. And he's actually very, very good, holding his own against Meryl Streep, which is a pretty tough way to kick things off. There's a lot of charm here. I am perhaps softening on it as time passes since I saw it, so I'm just going to say that right now, because the characters are interesting, and there's really interesting ideas about how a woman who pursues her career is regarded compared to maybe a man who would have, how he might have behaved in the same circumstances. Because she's a terrible mother, but at the same time, maybe that's okay in some ways, you know, maybe she's kind of doing her best. So there's an interesting little kind of family dynamic going on here. There's no real arc, there's no real growth, there's no real through line particularly here, but it does have a charm. But it just felt to me like every character needed one more really good scene to sort of bring them to life fully. And so it does drag just a little because you're not quite as involved as you should be. So I gave it 2. It's a high 2. I did flirt with a 3, but that's probably right.
You're such a demi-hater.
So anyway, 2 stars for Ricky and the Flash, is what I'm saying.
Let's move on to the other film this week. We had him on the podcast last week. He was our podcast guest, Ed Skrine. And now he's the star of the Transporter Refueled, yes. Daring to go where the state is no longer contractually obliged to.
I watched a bit of Transporter 3 last night. I don't know why. I was on Amazon and that was what I decided to watch.
I mean, I can understand watching Transporter 2, which is pleasantly ridiculous in a Fast and Furious style.
I'm drawn to its awfulness, like a moth to a flame. It's one of the worst films I've ever
seen.
Truly
shocking.
I remember seeing it with you, Chris. We were the only people in the room, and it was just shocking.
At the end, yeah. I think there were people
just dying around us, yeah.
It's shocking. The first, maybe not the first, but certainly the first I can remember seeing cinematic atrocity inflicted upon us by Olivier Megaton, whose films
last.
Have just never, ever lived up to that name. Mm. And he's went on to just ruin the Taken franchise single-handedly as well.
He's at best a mini-ton.
Well, this, I would say, is better than Transporter 3. I mean, you know, just to get back to the film we're actually reviewing.
Well, it's refueled. They've added fuel.
I'm not sure, actually, that they've added enough fuel. But I would say that I think Ed Skrine does a pretty good job of stepping into the Staith's, you know, enormous rock-hewn shoes.
I wonder where you were going with that.
I mean, because, you know, he does convince as a brawler. The film opens with a scene of him taking down, I think, 6 guys who are trying to steal his car. That's not a spoiler. And, you know, he convinces me as somebody who could beat up 6 guys who were trying to steal his car. So that's good. There's quite a cool scene later on where he leaves his car on neutral and it's sort of rolling along behind him as he just walks along beating up bad guys. That's quite cool as well. So I think there's no problem with him. The film has a couple of other good sort of innovations, if you will. First of all, his client and his passenger is Anna, who is a prostitute trying to escape from her gangster pimp with a gang of friends. That's interesting because it means that the girls are the one with the master plan here. They are the criminal masterminds, and Frank is just kind of going along for the ride, which kind of, you know, gives it a slightly different dynamic. You also have the introduction of Frank Martin's father. He was not Hewan from The Living Rock, as we always assumed.
No, he was Hewan from The Living Ray Stevenson.
He was Hewan from Ray Stevenson.
Is he called Martin Martin?
He's called Frank Sr. And he refers to his son incessantly as Junior, giving this a nice Last Crusade sort of vibe. And they're actually a lot of fun together because Ray Stevenson is clearly having the time of his life. So that's kind of an interesting little dynamic. It also gives us an alternative hostage, potential hostage, for any situation requiring one, rather than a screaming girl, which mm-hmm. I always appreciate. So, mm-hmm. you know, some nice innovations there. I think the problem is that the script is pretty bad. The dialogue is frequently awful. And the action is rarely as great as you want it to be. I think in this post Fast and Furious world, your action, if it's going to be ridiculous, needs to be ridiculous with a capital R.
Is there anything as inspired as the hose fight from Transporter 2?
There's a nice little piece with 4 enormous bad guys in a locked room. It's not as good as the hose or the oil or whatever else. Some of those very choreographed moments we've had. There's a really good car stunt involving 5 inexplicably placed water hydrants, which I really enjoyed. And there's a bit in an airport that's just not quite as amazing as you want it to be. You know, it's just it's okay. I think also the climax of the film is something we've seen a million times in kind of low budget movies, which is a bit on a small boat, like. All right, okay, but don't really care. So it's not, no, I mean, yeah, I don't really care about small boats. I don't have one and I don't really care what happens to it, so.
Don't let jealousy cloud your review, Helen.
But I think this is actually, you know, it's a good result for Skrine. It's a good result for Stevenson. I think they had a lot of fun and I think they're pretty good in the roles. I just think the script needed at least one more draft, if not 3 or 4, and the action needed another 10 or 15 million probably.
It's okay. A bit like the Hitman thing though, isn't it? They're just rebooting everything at this point. There's no one was asking for another Transporter film, I don't think, were they?
Luc Besson's accountant.
People like it because of the Staith. It's not a beloved character, I don't think, particularly.
Skrine does kind of convince you that, you know, this is an interesting kind of guy. There's not much about in the way of character, but, you know, he does the same sort of thing of being very buttoned up and very exacting in his life and then, of course, breaking all his own rules by the time we're 15 minutes in.
We have to ask, inspired by Transporter 3's most notorious exchange in this movie, is Frank Martin the gay?
In this movie, Frank Martin gets a little bit of action.
Frank Martin is not the gay.
Frank Martin is not the gay.
I'm not the gay. Tell me why we hated Transporter 3 again. I mean, that's possibly the greatest single dialogue exchange in the history of cinema. Olivia Megaton, I take it all back. Yes, The Transporter Refueled is, of course, a 3-star film, which, as we always end the podcast, is a recommendation. Also out this week is Rick Famuyiwa's Dope, which is a Quentin Tarantino-esque crime thriller set in Los Angeles. It's got a lot of energy, a lot of panache, a lot of pizzazz. We gave that 4 stars. And there's Owen Wilson, Lake Bell, and Pierce Brosnan in No Escape, which is a Luc Besson-esque thriller. You could say we didn't like that very much. We gave it 2 stars. Team Pod hasn't seen it, so therefore we can't talk about it, although I believe there's a bit in it where Owen Wilson throws his young daughters off the roof of a building.
I mean, onto the roof of another building.
Onto the roof of another building, yeah. Where his wife's waiting to catch them, but nevertheless.
Yeah.
That movie could have been the second Lake Bell movie this year to be called Man Up. All of Lake Bell's movies from now on should be called Man Up. So there you go. That's it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun, where we'll be joined by another double whammy of guests. I know. Making a habit of this. Well, again, it's kind of 3 people. We'll be joined once again by Kiosko Delario.
Ooh.
Star of Maze Runner. Mm-hmm. And now Maze Runner, The Scorched Trials. Her director, Wes Ball, will also be along, which is very, very exciting. And M. Night Shyamalan.
Ooh, what's the twist?
M. Night Shyamalan. The twist is he's coming in to talk to us about his new movie, The Visit. Didn't see that one coming. Did not see that one coming. So that's very, very exciting. Until then, thank you for listening. It's goodbye from Helen.
Toodaloo.
It's goodbye from Nick.
Pip, pip.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to find out the name of the new Reacher book because, quite frankly, I'm getting exasperated with Helen. She won't tell me what it is.
Make me.
Helen, for the last time, I don't want to make you tell me what it is. Just tell me what it is.
Make me.
Oh, for the love of God. See you guys next week.